Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Money talks, always has. And as of the Supreme Court's ruling today, it is going to talk even louder come election time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 21st of January, and it is good to have you with us. For years, one of the underlying principles of campaign finance law in this country has been that in politics, money is speech, which means there are some pretty strong First Amendment protections about who gets to spend how much on political campaigns. Those protections got a whole lot stronger today with the Supreme Court's ruling in a case called Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission. In a 5-4 decision, the justices pretty much abolished limits on corporate spending in national political races. From Washington, Brett Neely starts us off.
Until today, companies and labor unions could not spend their own money for or against a political candidate. They were limited to passing on contributions from their employees or members. They also could not air issue ads close to elections. The conservative court majority threw out those restrictions on free speech grounds. Companies and unions can now spend as much cash as they want to support or oppose a candidate through advertising. But the court kept an existing ban on direct contributions to candidates' campaigns. Today's decision centered on Citizens United, a small conservative advocacy group. It aired an anti-Hillary Clinton documentary in 2008, financed by corporate donors. On the steps of the Supreme Court this morning, Citizens United head David Bossie was ecstatic.
Whether you're an individual, whether you're a corporation, or a union, it doesn't matter. You can now participate fully and freely in the election process.
In a written statement this afternoon, President Obama said the court's decision further drowns out the voices of average Americans in politics. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
This ruling would have been a big deal whenever it came down, but coming as it did during the same week as that big Senate election in Massachusetts and in the run-up to this fall's congressional races, well, the possibilities are pretty much endless. Dahlia Lithwick covers the Supreme Court for Slate.com. Dahlia, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Look forward for me to the 2010 midterm elections here. We've got 10 months to go, plus or minus. Does this decision today mean that we're going to have banks and healthcare companies and labor unions out there just spending money willy-nilly?
I suspect as much. I think that pretty much everybody agrees this is going to, the word you're going to hear a lot today is open the floodgates of corporate spending, and that will by and large benefit the Republicans more than the Democrats.
Unions also, though, get to spend, right?
Yes, they do get to spend, although Lyle Denniston at SCOTUS blog just pointed out today that it's not clear that they're quite as free as corporations to spend as much as they want.
Yeah, as with most of this, it's all going to be sort of developed as we go on in the politics of this, right?
I think that's true. What we heard a lot of today was the good government groups and the campaign finance reform group saying this is the beginning of the end. The sky is falling. Democracy 21, one of those groups, issued a statement saying, quote, during 2008 alone, ExxonMobil generated profits of $45 billion with a diversion of even 2% of those profits to the political process. This one company could have outspent both presidential candidates and fundamentally changed the dynamic of the 2008 election. On the other end of the spectrum, you're getting groups who have really supported the notion of giving corporate speech a certain amount of constitutional personhood, saying, no, this isn't going to open any floodgates. The lawyer for Citizens United in this case, Ted Olson, said, quote, the vast majority of corporations are either nonprofit advocacy groups like Citizens United themselves or just small businesses. And this is going to really, he said, quote, enable them to band together to counterbalance the political speech of the rich.
For all of what you just said on either side of this discussion, there is a chance that it might increase transparency. I mean, we've had these 527 groups over the past 5 or 6 years without really knowing a lot about their donors. Now we're going to have these companies. They're going to have to declare. Could that be a positive?
Well, the one thing that the court agreed on today was that the disclosure provisions of the campaign finance laws remain intact. So we're going to have transparency. But I think most folks say that's really a drop in the bucket compared to the enormity of what was unloosed today.
I read a great post today. It might have actually been on Slate, as a matter of fact, that said, you know, this is basically the deregulation of the political process, if you think about it.
Well, it is. And I think it's really important to look at it in the constitutional context of this is the court going way beyond the four corners of what they needed to do to decide this particular case. This was a case about a movie, remember. It was a very, very narrow question when the court first got it last term. A lot of folks are comparing this, I think not completely inaptly, to Bush v. Gore in terms of the court reaching way out to take on an issue that didn't need to be quite this explosive.
Is Congress now going to reach out and try to sort of corral the court and change the finance law so they stand up to this scrutiny?
There's all sorts of talk about that. And one of the first things we heard on the announcement of the opinion was that Congress is going to get back to work and try to figure out some way to get around this. But I think that for the most part, Congress really has an uphill battle to get back to anything that looks like the last century's worth of campaign finance law.
Dahlia Lithwick, she's a senior legal correspondent at Slate.com. Dahlia, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
There may well be more money going into politics, but money was leaving the stock market today in droves. Details, numbers, when we get there. On pretty much any other day, President Obama's remarks about banks would have been higher up in this program because the president had some more harsh words for Wall Street today, saying the economic crisis started when banks took, and here I quote, huge reckless bets in pursuit of quick profits and massive bonuses. Mr. Obama offered two ideas for financial reforms this afternoon. One, make big banks smaller. We've heard that before. But also, don't let them do what are called proprietary trades. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains.
Proprietary trading is when a bank makes money for itself by using its own cash to make big and often risky bets. President Obama wants to stop it.
Banks will no longer be allowed to own, invest, or sponsor hedge funds, private equity funds, or proprietary trading operations for their own profit.
Here's the problem. Banks are making those risky bets because they have deposits to back them. If they lose big enough, the banks could fail. And that could pull down the financial system. Doug Diamond is a finance professor at the University of Chicago's Business School. He says Obama's going after proprietary trading to limit the kinds of risks banks can take.
It became so clear that the government will step in to bail out a systemically important institution that the genie is out of the bottle, and the ability to use this implicit government guarantee as a way to lever up things like proprietary trading is something that needs to be reined in.
Obama said proprietary trading operations abuse privileges banks have, like access to cheap capital from the Federal Reserve and deposit insurance. That's given banks an advantage over other investors. James Brock is an economics professor at Miami University.
I think they've been allowed to operate in a kind of twilight zone here lately, where it's heads they win and tails we lose.
Obama also wants to limit how big financial institutions can get. It may all be moot, though. With no supermajority in the Senate, it'll be hard to get any of these resolutions passed. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The stock market didn't much care for what the president had to say today. Rumors of the White House plan started leaking out last night, and all three major indices suffered right from the opening bell this morning. Financial shares led the way down. And that didn't quite match up with some other news today. The Goldman Sachs cleared just under $5 billion last quarter. Goldman is one of the banks that is sure to be affected by the president's proposals if they do become law, especially that part about trading with its own money. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott is on the line to talk about that. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Kai.
So the president was talking today about these proprietary trading desks, as Elisa was just telling us about, and how much money they make for the firms. We had a real-life example of that with Goldman Sachs profits this morning. How profitable is it?
Well, we don't know exactly, but Goldman's chief financial officer said today that about 10% of the firm's revenue comes from its proprietary trading desk, where the traders are just playing with the firm's money. But, you know, a lot of the trading that they do that is theoretically on clients' behalf, like taking the other side of a trade, still benefits the firm. And all of that trading made the firm a lot of money last year. But another big part of what drove Goldman's profits up is that it's set aside a much smaller share of its money for bonuses.
Well, this is where I wanted to stop you, because it's my understanding that Wall Street's claim about these bonuses and their size is that, listen, we have to pay them or people are just going to go work somewhere else. But now Goldman says maybe not.
Well, we should put this in perspective. Goldman is still paying out almost $500,000 per employee on average. So we're not talking chump change, even though the overall amount of just over $16 billion is still lower than it was a couple of years ago. But Goldman is paying less than 38% of its revenue in compensation. Typically, it pays closer to half. So it's apparently calculated that the risk of this political backlash was greater than, you know, that of people walking out the door. Shareholders have sued the company. They've had protesters outside their headquarters in Lower Manhattan. And Goldman's CFO said today that the firm is not deaf to these calls for restraint.
What are the odds, would you say, that this is an actual change of heart on the part of Goldman Sachs and maybe eventually by all of Wall Street? Or it's just done in the heat of battle to dodge the political bullet?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, I talked to a Goldman spokesman today who wouldn't speculate about future compensation. And I also talked to other people who say, you know, right now Goldman is aware that people hate bankers, and this is maybe a temporary solution, reducing that overall figure that it pays in bonuses. But what might change, they say, is how these firms pay their bonuses. There's already been more emphasis on long-term incentives, less incentives that might encourage, you know, risky behavior. The top 30 executives at Goldman Sachs will get their bonuses paid completely in stock that they can't cash in for 5 years. So there are some indications that there might be some real changes, even if the amounts that we're seeing are still mind-boggling.
Wall Street bonuses, the story that keeps on giving. Marketplace's Amy Scott in New York. Thanks, Amy.
You're welcome.
Coming up, the high cost of cheap health care.
If you're a cola drinker in New York or D.C.
Except that's not the cut. We'll do it anyway. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials plunged 2% today. That is 213 points, closed at 10,389. The Nasdaq crumpled 1.1%, 25 points, 2265 at the bell. The S&P 500 belted down nearly 2%, 21 points, ended at 1116. Goldman Sachs announced those bumper earnings, but the president's proposals put the company's shares into reverse. They lost more than 4% today. All the big banks followed Goldman lower. J.P. Morgan fell 6.5%. Bank of America plundered down 6%. Goldman Sachs slipped 4%, and Citigroup fell more than 5%. Continental Airlines and Southwest Airlines reported some better-than-expected earnings, but only Southwest got off the ground, rose more than 3%. Continental fell 2.25%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. An eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the House Financial Services Committee examines compensation in the financial industry. The sheriffs in town, the National Sheriffs Association, continues its winter conference in the nation's capital. And it's the 37th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. the historic Supreme Court ruling legalizing abortion. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Governor David Patterson released New York's budget this week. The Empire State is looking at a hole of more than $7 billion. So Patterson is looking everywhere he can for new money. That includes a tax on soft drinks. Non-diet sodas would be hit with an additional 18%. Sally Herships explains that growing concerns about unhealthy effects has the soft drink industry shrinking.
If you're a cola drinker in New York or D.C., you may have noticed something new on grocery store shelves. Little cans of Coke. The cans we're used to are 12 ounces. The new ones are only 7.5. From parents to governments, there's a war on soda, and the mini cans are Coke's answer.
If you're Coke, this is a very scary moment.
Tim Calkins is a professor of marketing at Northwestern University. Calkins says it's not just New York and not just Coke. Across the country, sales of carbonated drinks have slowly been slipping, for the past 5 years. People are worried about their health, so Coke is fighting back with a new, smaller can.
And by getting out a 90-calorie serving size, what it says is, well, you know, that's not so bad. I mean, that's not even like eating an apple. That's really not a big issue.
Calkins says that's what Coke wants us to think when we drink. So does a smaller can mean we'll drink more soda or less? Tom Mavis is a professor of consumer behavior at NYU.
Again, we are mindless eaters and mindless drinkers.
Mavis says when we drink, we don't think. He told me about a study done on soup drinkers. Participants were given bowls of soup. Some were normal, but some had tubes hidden underneath, which secretly refilled them. So as people ate, their bowls kept filling back up. By the end of the study, the diners with the rigged bowls ate over 70% more soup, but they didn't believe they had.
We just keep on eating and drinking until a plate is empty or, you know, a cup is empty.
So putting Coke in a smaller can could get consumers to drink less. Mavis says that when food and drinks are individually packaged, people tend to eat less. Pretend you get a bag of chocolates. You'll just mindlessly eat them.
But then if I wrap the chocolates individually, then what's going to happen is you'll eat less. You'll eat 5 or 6.
Instead of the whole bag, the wrappers act as an external cue. Each time you reach for new chocolate, you have to unwrap it. And unwrapping forces you to make a decision, which is what you have to do when you open a new can of Coke. But what makes you open a new can? To find out, I headed to my local Target.
Is it enjoyment? Is it a nourishment? Is it health? Is it price?
It's addiction.
Consumer behavior professor Tom Mavis says while the new cans do have the potential to reduce consumption, it's not likely to happen, even though a smaller package of Coke means a bigger price per ounce. Mavis says if consumers do drink less soda, they may end up eating more of something else, like dessert. In the soft drink aisle in Brooklyn, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
See if you can guess when and why Coke was invented. You can check out our newest online feature. It's called the Daily Nugget, and it's on our website. It's marketplace.org. We are now 21 days into 2010, so how are you doing with your New Year's resolutions? Are you actually following through, or have they been tossed on the pile of ignored good intentions? If so, commentator Casey Cole says you've got science on your side.
Ever wonder why it's so hard to keep those New Year's resolutions, get off the couch and exercise every day, drop that $4-a-day latte habit for some homebrew, stop getting into the same stupid social dynamics and start trying more productive tactics? Turn around a business, or for that matter, an economy. Much of the problem is inertia. We all know that it takes energy to get started on something, whether it's propelling yourself out of bed or propelling a rocket to Mars. What we don't tend to appreciate is how hard it is to stop what you're already doing. In fact, it's relatively easy to blast your way to a distant planet compared to what it takes to slow down your spacecraft once you get there. The same is true of anything. Slide into second base, move journalism from print to online, resist the temptation to pay out huge bonuses? In terms of energy required, there's no difference between a startup and a stop-down. At bottom, inertia is simply resistance to change. Fighting it is hard and frequently generates heat. Of course, massive organizations and massive economies have far more inertia than small ones. Why? Certainly, complexity is part of the equation. The more tangled the web, the harder it is to move one piece without bringing along all the rest. But today, physicists are seeking the source of inertia in a kind of cosmic molasses that pervades what we think of as empty space, the so-called Higgs field. If they're right, evidence for this stuff may well show up in the new particle collider recently revved up in Europe. Such a discovery wouldn't make it any easier to change personal habits or national policy, but it's somehow comforting to know that inertia is built into the stuff of the cosmos itself. When change is hard, you can always blame the universe.
Casey Cole is a professor of journalism at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California. Her most recent book is called Something Incredibly Wonderful Happens, Frank Oppenheimer and the World He Made Up. Take a minute to tell us what you think. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Democratic leaders in Congress are going back and forth with the president about the fate of the health care bill. They are trying to figure out what to do after Tuesday's election in Massachusetts. In the meanwhile, though, the basic conundrum remains. Health care is not getting any cheaper. And that's why this next story is so interesting. Because when consumers think about prices, the logic is usually that cheaper is better. But that's a problem in health care because so many of the true costs are hidden from the consumer. It's that cheaper may actually be worse. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner explains.
The afternoon I stopped by the Hotel and Restaurant Employee Dental Center in downtown Los Angeles, dentist Roger Fieldman had just done one of his most dramatic before and afters.
Oh, you should have seen what we just did.
He'd replaced some dentures.
And this happens to be one of the most horrible-looking partial dentures we've ever seen. And he's been going like that for years.
Fieldman's patients are all union workers, waitresses and bellmen, members of the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, Local 11. Before they joined the union, most of them were lucky to have any dental care, much less at these prices.
A root canal is $20. X-rays, cleanings are free. Fillings are $3. A denture is $85.
The reason the clinic can charge so little is that all its costs are covered by a union trust fund that the employers, the big hotel and restaurant chains, pay into.
Raleigh?
The fund is managed by one man.
Raleigh Throckmorton.
Raleigh Throckmorton is 76 years old. He wears blue suspenders and sits at a desk engulfed by worksheets and tables. He says that the employer contributions to the fund have risen over the years with the cost of health care.
Well, in 1964, as I recall, the contribution rate was 15 cents an hour.
And now it's
$4.21 an hour. When you have, you know, 1.25 million hours a month, that does add up.
It adds up to over $50 million a year, which for some 7,000 union workers and their dependents means all-inclusive medical benefits, plus dental. Which brings us back to Roger Fieldman. There's a downside to providing good care at cheap prices.
We have a high no-show rate because essentially their dentistry is almost free.
The clinic's no-show rate, that's patients who miss appointments and didn't call to cancel, is 20 to 25%. In his old private practice, it was 5%.
We might have a two-hour appointment for some complex surgery, some dental implants, and then they just don't show up. And for 2 hours of doctor and assistant time, what is the value of that? $1,000 more? The patient's paying $6.
$6 being the fee for no-shows.
When it's only $6, there's very little incentive, if it's not convenient, for them to keep the appointment.
Throckmorton says if there's one thing he's learned after balancing the books on the union's trust fund for all these decades, it's this, that when money is not a factor, people do not think much about waste. Take, for example, the emergency room.
We have no emergency room charge.
Some members will use the emergency room at any sign of sickness.
If there are any doubt about it, they go.
Or just because it's convenient, because there's no copay.
Now, they can't evaluate them and tell them, you've just got a cold. You don't belong in emergency care. The hospital is obligated by law to see them in the emergency room. The cost is a minimum of $700.
Which the fund, of course, pays for. Now, for years, the union didn't make a big deal about how much health care people used. They wanted to give their members the most access to care, until the recession slammed the hospitality industry.
Just almost like driving off a cliff.
Union workers' hours fell 20%. Employer contributions, of course, dropped. The fund was spending more than what was coming in.
We were deficit spending at the rate of over $1 million a month, bleeding.
Tom Walsh is the union president.
So we did something that unions don't usually do, and we went to our members and said, look, here's the problem.
The union couldn't go back to the employers and ask for more money, not with the industry still in trouble. So union leaders voted to slap a copay on emergency room visits. It kicks in next month.
We thought a $50 copay was something reasonable.
And effective. Throckmorton calculates that visits to the emergency room will drop in half. That alone will save the fund $500,000 a month.
So, Raleigh, let me ask you, are you worried that people who are sick are not going to go to the doctor?
There will be some of that.
Raleigh was pretty blunt about this. He says if you're going to cut costs, you're going to risk that some people who should have gone to the emergency room didn't because of the copay. How many people is a number that even Raleigh Throckmorton can't calculate. All he knows is how many visits the union can afford. In Los Angeles, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note this afternoon, a couple of them, actually, about the internet and you. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton gave a big speech this morning about internet freedom and what it means in the context of American foreign policy. Talking about the news that Google is thinking of pulling out of China after what looked like government-sponsored cyber attacks there, the secretary said the United States will be talking specifically about the Google case with the Chinese sometime in the near future. Google itself, by the way, reported BAFO profits today after the bell, $2 billion in the last 3 months of 2009, although revenue growth was down. And finally this afternoon, passwords. The internet security firm Imperva did a study of 32 million passwords were stolen a couple of weeks ago from a company that does security software for a bunch of businesses. The most popular password by, like, miles, 123456, which I would offer is just not all that secure. Maybe I want to think about that. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow unloaded 213 points. That is 2%. The NASDAQ cranked down 25 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 lost 21 points, nearly 2%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this broadcast, Printers Ink, like liquid gold, baby.
It's way, way up there. It's probably one of the most expensive liquids that you can buy.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.